Signatures.
That's why we just came away.
Good morning, everyone. Today, we're going to take a look at the actual tax credits that have been amendments in the forms of the dash twos, dash threes, dash fours. Remember, there's kind of two tracks to this. One is the credits that will make the list, and the other side is the one we looked at the other day, the amendment that, or this, the side of this bill that looks at technical fixes to the Student Success Act, which will come back in a form of another amendment next week and will be considerably different than the one we previewed the other day. So for now, let's look at the twos, threes, and fours. There are some good news in respect to a Department of Revenue note. I'll let these guys explain. It says the retiring credits or the sunsetting credits that we may renew are coming in at a less cost than what was originally anticipated. So, we'll start off after a question from Rep. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I just wanted to let the committee and the public know at 9 o'clock I'll be leaving to head to Ways and Means, and so I didn't want anyone to think I was participating.
Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Mr. Alanek.
Good morning, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. So to start off, in all this, we have a dash two, dash three, and dash four, and there is a summary table about the tax credits that describes each of the amendments. The main amendment, if you will, is dash two. That is where there seems to be consensus about tax credits or other policies that would be included in the bill. And then the dash three and the dash four contain one amendment each. And then Kyle will come up in a minute to walk through all of those pieces. To set off the discussion, though, I did want to provide some context about the updated data that the co-chair was just referring to. The Department of Revenue released tax year 2017 personal income tax statistics. So we've updated our models and our with that information. And the upshot of that is the earned income tax credit cost was coming in less than had it been expected. So the cost to extend all of the existing tax credits, this is just a simple extension to take those 9 tax credits and move them forward, instead of costing $68 million in this biennium, in the 1921 biennium, it would cost an estimated just under $65 million, about $64.7 million. So that gives the committee about $3 million more to spend. And so probably with that, I'll ask Kyle to kind of walk through the table, which touches on each of the amendments.
How are you, Representative?
Marvelous, thank you.
Okay. Good morning, respective chairs, members of the committee. Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. And yeah, as Chris just mentioned on the earned income tax credit, we did see the numbers come in a little bit below originally, so that has been adjusted in the numbers you see in front of you in the table in front of you as well. And that's part of the reason for the changes from the previous table that was seen a couple weeks ago in this committee. But again, so it's the way that this table just organizes is by the amendments that are in OLS. So the dash two, again, is kind of the amendment with most of the changes in there. And so just starting off with sections 2 to 5 of the amendment contain the contents of the 529 subtraction change, where the 529, this is the education contributions or the ABLE contribution account contributions, is being changed from a subtraction to a refundable credit. And both committees heard from the Treasury's office on this one, on the idea being trying to convert the credit structure to try to incentivize more use by some of those taxpayers that are lower down the income spectrum than are currently taking the subtraction right now. But it was designed in a revenue neutral approach. And that's part of the reason you see the estimate in the table there is in the first biennia and the following one, we see an actual slight revenue lift followed by a little revenue drop, the negative 0.9 million there in 2325. But so that's the first change. And again, all these, the contents of the amendments, this is language that's coming from other bills or the bills that are in the committee right now today that were in the previous listing. So it's just more or less a copy and paste of the individual language from those bills in getting into this omnibus amendment. So that's the first one. The next is the cultural trust contributions. That's sections 6 and 7. And I should mention on page two of this, so the second page beyond the table, is just a quick blurb description of kind of a reminder of what it is this credit is. So again, this is just a credit for matched contributions to the cultural trust. So for a taxpayer, they first have to make a contribution of equal or greater value to an Oregon cultural organization. They then make a donation to the cultural trust, and they can receive a credit for that. The next two that we have in the list, sections 8 through 14, have to do with manufactured dwelling parks. The first is a capital gain subtraction. If someone who owns, a taxpayer who owns this, then sells the park to, it's going to be like a nonprofit or residents of the park, if they do that, they can then have a subtraction for the capital gains on that. So an incentive for someone who's selling a park to sell it to those type of entities. The second one there is manufactured dwelling park closure credit. Again, this is a $5,000 refundable credit for individuals that own manufactured dwelling structures in a park that's closing. Next on the list, section 15, this is certain retirement income. This is just standard six-year sunset extension for this one, along with section 16, the volunteer rural emergency medical services providers. This is commonly thought of as a credit for EMTs. It's a $250 credit for EMTs that are volunteering in rural areas. Next, we have employer-provided scholarships. So this is available for employers to set up scholarship programs. I can cover 50% of the amount of the qualified scholarship program, again, incentivizing an employer to set up one of these scholarship programs. We have moving down, section 18 is the agriculture workforce housing construction credit. So we have that's the sunset extension. And then there's a slight change to in the sunset extension to ensure that the interpretation of that sunset does allow for taxpayers that are already receiving this credit will continue to do so for the full length of time of the credit. So it's just a tweak of the existing language to really make that administratable in line with the policy the legislature has previously adopted there. And then section 19 is the earned income tax credit. And again, that's where you really see about the adjustment to the previous estimates are out there. It's down about the cost to extend is about $3.5 million less than what was previously put out there. And again, that's following in line with the most recent data that we've received. So those are the general fund pieces. Those are the credits and the subtraction piece. So that's what's touching on the general fund. Sections 20 through 24 then pick up with property taxes. So we have the property tax exemption for low-income rental housing. And this is newly constructed rental housing that is then occupied by low-income persons. And there is a property tax exemption available for up to 20 years for that one. And this is language, again, this is language that's coming in some cases from other bills that's then being inserted here. So nothing else is being changed. Sections 25 and 26, this was mentioned a couple weeks ago of a sunset extension. This was got caught up in the implicit sunsets that this committee has heard about a bit and then previous meetings. But vehicles used for testing emissions, it's extending that sunset from the gas and use fuel taxes and the weight mile tax as well. So that's the contents of House Bill 2164, the dash two amendment. So that's the longest of the amendments there. And then we have two separate amendments, as Chris mentioned. The first is the dash three, which is the food processing equipment. This is a property tax exemption for newly acquired food processing equipment. It's a five-year exemption. And there is language in here that, again, is in the contents of the other bill this came from about adding a local option where a county could opt out of this exemption being in place. So that language is what's in there in the food processing equipment. That's part of the reason we have a to be determined at this point in the revenue impact, still working through how that option for the county to opt out would interplay with the existing just standard sunset extension of this property tax exemption. And then the last one, there's the dash four amendment. This is the political contributions tax credit. So again, this is the six-year sunset extension of that tax credit, and it's a $50 or $100 credit for a taxpayer that makes a contribution to, in this case, it'd be a political party, a candidate, or a political action committee. They can receive a credit for that. So again, that's just a high-level kind of refresher of what these are. happy to go in any more detail or take questions. We'd like to proceed.
Thank you, Kyle. Before we go any further, I forgot to mention that Senator Bentz is on the line with us, making a rare exception to our phone-in rule. Exception being, if you live in Ontario, you can do it. So, Senator Bentz, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
When I add these up, I get the twos, threes, and fours somewhere around 64 million. We have 70 million budgeted for these. So, in that respect, we're in good shape. Any questions of these tax credits that we're talking about? Yes, Rep. Nathan.
Thank you. I'd like to ask Mr. Easton to just underscore for us the items that are on the board right now. Maybe there's one exception. Those are simply extending a policy as it exists currently. They don't represent expansion of a policy, like to include different persons or to change a threshold, or is that correct?
Co-Chair Nathanson, excluding the 529, which is kind of a separate one, the remainder of these, most of them are going to be the credit sunset extensions, just that standard sunset extension. And then, I guess the property tax or the food processing, would be the other exception there of adding that local option for the counties to opt in or out, I suppose, would be the other difference there. But the remainder, I'm just quickly scanning the list to make sure I'm getting that right, is, other than a technical change here or there to align, these are just your standard extension, yes.
No expansion of who qualifies or how much is available for a credit.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Rep. Warren-Rich.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Kyle, again, on the Dash 3 amendment with food processing equipment, is the default for a county opt-in or is it opt-out? So if a county does nothing, what's the default?
Yeah, Representative Reschke, I believe it's the county has to adopt an ordinance or resolution to opt out of it,
okay.
And then they can adopt an ordinance resolution following that to opt back in.
Okay. And then just to follow up real quick, thanks. And is that 100% opt-in, opt-out? There's no, they can't do 50% or 75%, just it's all in or all out, correct?
Yes, that's correct. It would be for all the taxing districts as well, not just the county taxing district.
Okay, thank you.
I would think that there was a lot of discussion about the property tax for food processing equipment in the House Revenue Committee concerning different options and potential changes to it. This is a great program for my district. I have several facilities that use this program, and I think the Dash 3 answers most of the issues and addresses things quite well with the opt-out capability. I think it's a great program. I highly encourage and we support that.
Rep. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I want to echo what my colleagues have just shared. I've had the opportunity to sit across the table from food processing executives as they're trying to make decisions whether to locate in Oregon or to expand their business in Oregon. And this food processing equipment credit is extraordinarily important to them in their decision making. If you look at the economic success in West Umatilla County and Northern Morro County, I would place much of it that as a result of this. And that has resulted in millions and millions of dollars of tax revenue coming into the state of Oregon and into Morro and Umatilla County and those cities. And so while there may be a small amount of money that we lose by providing this credit, millions more are brought into the state or kept in the state.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. I do have one other question. And there's one tax credit that's not on here that we had a lot of discussion about, and that's the Short Line Railroad tax credit. Is So I don't know whether that's a discussion point we can have. I mean, if we have, you know, it looks like we're below our target. I mean, in that, that would be something that I would certainly like to have a conversation about. I think short lines are nearly, they're spread throughout the state on north, south, east, and west, and it's a pretty good program for infrastructure. So.
Yeah. Okay. Rep. Smith-Warner.
I just want to say on the food processing credit front that I continue to urge us to balance what our policy goals are with tax credits, which is that we want to support industries, and we had this very similar conversation in the House Revenue Committee, but the balance between supporting industries to kind of get them to a good point to incentivize their work, yet not having our tax credit be part of their kind of profit structure. That the goal of tax credits, I believe, is to support an industry so that it can get to and stay at a solid place, but not have to depend on it for its. I don't want that to be part of, I mean, bluntly, it shouldn't be corporate welfare. It should be a support thing that to get an industry to a certain point. And food processing has been a significant success in this state. And with, I would venture that makes some a decent profit margin. So I just want us to, as we are figuring out what the final language is, let's make sure that it is an incentive that we're using it to make sure that we're getting job levels and it isn't just being baked into their profits.
Co-chair.
Thank you. I have another question for Mr. Easton. It's about cultural trust contributions. When we had a hearing in the House, some of the discussion was about how the change in the federal tax code has impacted contributions of all sorts, charitable contributions. In particular, when it relates to the cultural trust contribution, there was some suspicion that a decline in contributions could be related, at least in part, maybe a significant part, to this change in the federal tax code. Now that we have some additional data available to us, is there likely any change you would anticipate in the revenue impact for next year or the biennium after that? Have things settled down to a point where we have maybe more confidence in estimating what the size of that will be?
Yes. Madam Co-Chair, the data that we received, the additional tax year 2017, again, is going to predate these federal changes. So unfortunately, it doesn't help us in seeing how things are looking post the federal changes. It's another year's worth of data, which is always helpful to see. Has there been any other softening going on or anything along those lines? But going forward, yeah, with the cultural trust, for part of the reasons that were discussed, in front of the House Revenue Committee of that concern with the federal and the changes and how that would be incorporated. The numbers you see in the table would be lower otherwise had that not occurred, just to try to account for some of that uncertainty. So certainly going forward, it's something we'll want to keep our eye on to see what happens there. But there is some softening in the base growth of these numbers already to try to account for that. But again, we'll see if it leads to maybe a year-over-year decline would certainly be surprising, as we have still growth in that credit built into our baseline forecast.
Thank you.
Rep. Mark, did you have a question?
I did have a question. Thank you, Chair. Back to food processing. It's the proposed amendment is an opt-out amendment. I'm more familiar with opt-in property tax programs at the local level. Do we have, is this a common application in other property tax exemptions to provide an opt out rather than opt in?
It depends. In some cases, if it's an opt in, it might be in how that the program is being designed. So in some cases, there is the legislature passes puts language in statute that allows the local government to do something, in which case it's giving them, you hear the, I guess the same, the tool in the toolbox or something along those lines. So it's giving them that ability to do that, in which case it may not be an opt-in. It may just be more of the local government needs to establish this program. It doesn't start where it's established statewide. So in that case, I don't know if that's would be considered an opt-in or just mm-hmm. gives them the option to do that. And then in other cases, there can be ones where certainly if enough of the local governments, sometimes it can be a threshold of 50% of the districts or 75 or something on those lines, choose not to partake in this, they can opt out. But I don't think there's one, there's probably not one standard way. I could definitely kind of do a survey of these ones that we have that are opt-in, opt-out. But I think it depends a lot of times on if a local government, say a county, establishes this, they may need to get the authority of the other districts to do that, in which case it wouldn't happen unless they're getting them to opt-in to begin with.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I want to add to my earlier comments. For rural Oregon, particularly rural eastern Oregon, changing political dynamics have eliminated the timber industry. And so now the economies in eastern Oregon really are dependent upon three industry sectors. The first is agriculture. The second is government, major federal, state, county, local government, school districts, et cetera. And the third is tourism. We really don't have the ability to diversify our base into high technology or manufacturing that requires multiple parts because the cost of transportation is cost prohibitive. And so one of the things that we may want to look at if we want to keep agricultural vibrant in Oregon, particularly eastern Oregon, is what is our competition doing? What's occurring in Washington? What's occurring in Idaho, Utah, Nevada, as it relates to those states supporting the agricultural industry? And I think if we do our homework, we're going to find out how valuable this tool is to the state of Oregon in generating revenue. So I would encourage all to either meet with the Department of Ag or have them come and present to us to tell us what our competition is doing. Final thought, and this is just a brief geography lesson. In West Umatilla County, Morrow County, you have Interstate 82 that is a hop and a skip and maybe a little jump into the state of Washington, where food processing is booming as well. And so there's a real competition between Oregon and Washington to attract those good jobs. And I'd let Representative Finley or Senator Bentz share a similar story in Malheur County, where it is very, very easy for industry to take those good family wage jobs and cross a border and locate. They can still do their farming in Oregon, but they do their processing in Idaho. And I would hate for us to lose millions and millions of dollars of tax revenue by being a little bit short-sighted on this. So thank you for letting me share that thought.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I'll speak to that briefly. Thank you, Representative. In Nessa, Oregon, the amalgamated sugar plant for 40 years processed sugar beets. They closed that plant, and now all the beets move on into Idaho. So they moved to Nampa, Idaho, where they do the processing of raw sugar beets. 25 years ago, there's a large amount of sweet corn grown and processed in eastern Oregon. It is no longer processed in eastern Oregon. It's now processed in Idaho. So we are losing market share to Idaho in the processing component of it. So, it's absolutely real and it's happening. So whatever we can do to help keep that industry in Oregon, we need to work at.
Thank you. Senator Vance, comments, questions?
Well, I would just thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I would just say that given the passage of the commercial activities tax and given the soon some sort of pricing of carbon of some sort, those two Oregon-specific increases in cost need to be taken into account when we're trying to think of what we might do for business or at least continue for business. So I'd sure want to have that on the table.
Thank you. Thank you. When we look at this list of tax credits, obviously the biggest one is a renewal of the earned income tax credit. We had a fascinating presentation 2 weeks ago, and I think some of our eyebrows were raised when we saw Oregon at the sort of the bottom quartile of the states that participate in that. I think we're at 8%. Kyle or Chris, can you just ballpark the costs required to move that from 8% to maybe 9 or 10%?
I think the baseline, the rule of thumb that we've been using for any 1 percentage point increase in the EIC costs roughly $6 million per year.
Per year. So say if we went from 8% to 10%, that $50 million would move up to about $62 million.
That would be our, I mean, we confirm it a little bit, but that's our, that would be our back of the envelope.
Okay.
A rule of thumb.
Good. Co-chair.
There's another tax credit that is sort of similar to EITC in that it's helping people help themselves. It's the IDA, Individual Development Account. It's not sunsetting now, if I recall, but there has been a proposal to expand it so that it's available to more people. Could you remind us what that costs?
Yeah, Co-Chair, I believe on the IDA bill, and I don't recall the number at this time of the bill number, but yeah, there was, if I'm remembering right, there's two changes in there, two really options is, one, there is, we have the annual cap, so you could maintain that annual cap of $7.5 million, but adjust the credit amount or the credit match to try to induce or continue to induce those contributions. And part of that, again, follows up on that conversation with the federal changes on how that will interact with the IDA and the other credits of similar structure. And then the second part of that would be just increasing that cap as well. And that's where if you make the changes of the contribution, but keep the cap in place, the cost of the program could stay the same, again, depending upon whether or not you're reacting to the federal changes. But then that stage two, that increasing of the cap, of course, is where we would expect you to actually start changing the cost to extend. I think it's fair to say that. So that's where you actually start, you know, quote, spending the money there. And I do think that the IDA credit, I believe, is up for renewal in 2021. So that would be part of the sunset extension discussion and will be in our background report as well in just in a couple of years. So,
we deal with it in the routine course of business in the next long session.
Yes.
But we do have, looks like it's Senate Bill 790 and House Bill 3133.
So I think part of what the cost there is the two pieces, the two policy parameters that Kyle was referring to can affect the cost to extend.
Yeah.
So if you wanted to expand it, increasing the percentage from 70% to something higher could be add cost,
yeah.
And then increasing the cap from $7.5 million to, say, $10 million would be a $2.5 million increase. Mm-hmm. I think one of the options in that policy was to double that. So it's we would need a little more direction on exactly which parameters you're looking at in terms of what the cost would be. I tend to refer to those as scalable policies. So especially when you're fitting into a cap, if you want to incorporate a policy, that is one that can be scaled.
Because in some kinds of cases, do you mind if I, thank you. In some kinds of programs, being scalable makes sense. Every little bit extra helps. In some, it doesn't make sense, and it's not really scalable. But thank you for clarifying that this one is a scalable option, a scalable program.
Okay, we'll continue to talk amongst ourselves. We did a questionnaire in the Senate, and some senators are communicating with me and take this in, add this, take this out, and we'll continue that over the weekend, I hope, and give us your patience on getting these amendments developed, passed. written, drafted, because there's a lot of other work at the building that's taking time of LRO, and so there is a lag time. So, but we will continue to shuffle the deck and look at this, probably with a meeting on Monday or Tuesday, so pay attention. Yes, Senator Bokos.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted for food for thought for individuals. I'm not quite sure how food processing came to the forefront. And Senator Bentz, who's out there, is the closest thing. I was going to go to your good vice chair to your right, but I did look that, you know, there's a lot of desert between you and Pendleton. Didn't follow exactly what the good representative was talking about with food processing. I just happened to know the Pendleton grain growers basically went under and had to dissolve, so I don't think that's so good. Seneca packed out after trying to make a run at it with one of the cooperatives and left in the last year. One of the cooperatives right now is teetering on bankruptcy in the Willamette Valley. I'm quite sure there's plenty of profiteering going on in certain areas, but there are other certain areas in food processing, certainly given the fact they're dissolving and leaving. And they are cooperatives, many of them. I think the comments of Senator Smith or Representative Smith, I mean, one of those, right? I think it's more complex than just saying a blunt statement. Second thing, Mr. Chair, is that I'm going to agree with the good Senator Smith to my left that, you know, we shouldn't be subsidizing certain things, but we all need to kind of stay focused here, because I did not attend the Wednesday meeting, but I certainly did read the last three pages of the amendment from Wednesday, and it certainly looked like we were going to try and subsidize some pretty large corporations who are paying dividends and whose stock is on the rise as of today. So I hope that amendment, you know, is now deceased in its form, because we need to treat everybody equally. Whether we agree or disagree, we need to treat them equally across the board. And I would just remind members, and I did talk to the good chair, and I'm happy to talk to you individually after a little research of the original A1 amendment. I think the number one individual company that would benefit from that actually hasn't even been mentioned in this room yet, and it sort of took me by surprise. So I would ask my colleagues to look in depth and study these between now and Monday or Tuesday, whatever, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay, committee, thank you. We will adjourn.